Okay, we will call together the meeting of the Judiciary Committee on January 30th at 1:12 p.m. Present with us are Representatives Toohey, Representatives Bundy, Representatives Green, myself, Representative Porter, Representative Vesey, and Representative Betty Davis. We have but one bill to consider today, and that's why we have waited a couple minutes before we got going. What I'd like to ask the indulgence of the committee on is to kind of consider this, since it's the only bill we have, a work session on this bill. We'll get an explanation of the changes on the draft that we've just received. And if it is that we have an understanding of it entirely and can deal with it, we'll try to deal with it. If it is that we think that there's some more work to be done, we will ask that that additional work be done if we agree on that point. We have one person who wishes to testify. It is a representative of the ACLU who just asked for that accommodation, which we will give, but we couldn't get the teleconference set up until 1:30. So we can spend the interim discussing what changes there are in this draft, and that this draft is being faxed as we speak to their office. Great. We have a lot of people here that want to testify on the bill. In any event, the representative of ACLU will have this draft at his or her disposal to deal with as they see fit. In any event, Representative Davis?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have Mr. Guarnelli from the Department of Law with us. And Dean, are you at a point where you could take us through here and explain the...
Yes, I am.
All right. For the record.
For the record, my name is Dean Guarnelli with the Department of Law. Let me just start out by saying that this draft, which is the M draft, does what I had hoped in that it starts with the current rule and then shows the language that has been added and indicates what language has been deleted. There's a lot of both, and so I think it's appropriate that we do go through it almost line by line. In general terms, let me just say that the approach was to provide some mandatory sharing of information on both sides, whether the defense wants to opt in or opt out to any greater discovery. If the defense wants to opt in and agrees to give over its information, then it gets additional information from the prosecution. That's the general approach. On Friday, Mr. Salemi gave testimony before the committee, which indicated that he thought that there were some changes that could be made to the current rule, and he outlined those specifically. After he did that, I went back and took a look at what is currently going on within the court system with respect to this rule. And the Criminal Rules Committee, which is a committee appointed by the court system to study its rules, has made some recommendations for changes along the lines that Mr. Salemi recommended, and has actually come up with a draft of their proposed changes. It's been submitted to the Supreme Court for the court's consideration. It occurred to me and to Mr. Luckout, the drafter, that we may be in a situation where we're trying to hit a moving target, in other words, trying to amend a rule that may be in the process of being amended right now by the Supreme Court. So it occurred to us that that it might be appropriate to incorporate in the changes that Mr. Salemi thought, you know, even from a defense attorney standpoint, would be appropriate adjustments to the rule, and that the Supreme Court is considering. And so we did that, and actually tightened up some of the language, which I can point out to the committee. So that in addition has been done. There are a couple of changes that should be made because it didn't come out exactly the right way. But in any event, I'll go through that. Starting on page one, we have what I will describe as mandatory discovery. In other words, mandatory disclosure of certain information to the accused. Starting out on the last line of page one, going to the top, is that information which tends to negate guilt or reduce person's punishment. That's the minimum constitutional standard. This language appears in the current rule, and so we've moved it up to a place where it is mandatory. Mm-hmm. Starting on lines 4 and 5, on request, grand jury materials as already provided under the criminal rules. those would be mandatory as well. In other words, there has been a court proceeding, a grand jury proceeding. It's been recorded. Probably transcripts have been made. And that, again, that minimal amount of information ought to go to the defense. Line 6 and 7 then go on to say that as a mandatory discovery, that information required by statute now should be provided as well. And then on lines 8 and 9, and this again is something from the 8, 9, 10, 11, this is something from the current rule. Anything that was obtained from the defendant, in other words, any property seized from the defendant, any of his books, diaries, photographs, those kinds of things. I mean, he had them at one point, and it's not gonna hurt us to disclose that we have seized that information. The defendant probably already knows it because of the search warrant requirements to let him know what has been seized. But that is the that's the level of mandatory disclosure that would have to be turned over to a defendant. Now, starting on lines 12 and 13 is mandatory information to be turned over to the prosecutor. AA, which starts on line 14, is sort of a truncated version of what the Criminal Rules Committee recommended go to the Supreme Court. The rest of what they recommended appears, unfortunately, on page 6, lines 12 to 19. For some reason, that got split up. And what I would recommend is that the provisions on page 6, lines 12 to 19, in other words, notice of any defenses. If the defense is going to rely on alibi, justification, duress, heat of passion, entrapment, all those things set out in statute and case law, the defense needs to give the prosecution notice of that. And that should be on a mandatory basis. It shouldn't be something that they can opt in or opt out. And that's something that was recommended by the Criminal Rules Committee as something appropriate. So my request would be that all of those lines be moved into the beginning of line 14, into that, and appropriate transitional language be added there. And that would, in essence, be the Criminal Rules Committee proposal.
So what you're asking is notice of defenses on line 12, page 6, become AA and everything else be adjusted downward?
Actually, that be part of AA. That'd be part of it. It would be a long section, but that's the way the Rules Committee set it out. And I've got that here if anyone wants to take a look at that.
And then current AA would just be, as you say, transitioned into the back side of what you're bringing over.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct.
Okay.
Now then, starting on going back to page 2 and working through the mandatory disclosure to the prosecutor. There's a provisions on lines 18 and 19 for the defendant to participate in non-testimonial identification procedures. These as well are set out in the current discovery rule, and it's something that should continue to be mandatory. Mr. Ruckop, as a drafting matter, thought that that ought to be, because it was a long, involved provision, that it ought to be set at the end of the rule and just a reference made to G of the section. So that has been set out, and it actually appears at pages 12 and 13. But that's something that, and that's a matter of simply photographs of the defendant, fingerprints, appearing in lineups, handwriting samples, things like that that are a common investigative resource. And really it applies to defendants who have been charged with crimes or anybody else where the investigation has focused on a narrow range of persons. You can get a court order to have someone appear in a lineup or take their photograph. So that should continue. On page 2, lines 20 and 21, again, the statutory requirements are made mandatory. And then starting on lines 22 and going on to the top of page 3, again, this is a requirement or a suggestion by the Criminal Rules Committee, which is that if the defendant's attorney has come into the possession of any physical evidence, that attorney has an obligation to turn that over to the prosecution, in essence, to turn it over to police. This is something that is required under case law. I mean, it's a matter of attorneys' ethical obligations to do that anyway. The Criminal Rules Committee thought it ought to be set out in the rule. Oftentimes, defense attorneys come into the possession of murder weapons, cash, things of that sort.
Bloody gloves.
And they have an obligation to turn those over to the prosecution. Now, the courts have also said, in order to preserve the confidential communications between attorney and client, if the attorney got that from his client, he doesn't have to tell the police where he got it. He just turns it over. If he got it from somewhere other than his client, then he's got to tell where he got it. But as I said, that's a matter of ethics. But this sets out a procedure for that to be done, and this is something that the Rules Committee recommended. Let's see. Now going on to the top of page 3, starting on line 3. That is just the provision that says, okay, once you've exchanged this mandatory information, then the defense has an opportunity to say whether he wants more information. And in order to get that additional information, he's got to agree to turn over additional things to the prosecutor. So that just simply says how that works out. Let's see. There is one additional item on line 4 where it says that the defendant shall file a written notice personally executed by the defendant. A question arose whether this is something that an attorney could do without consulting a client, and I don't think any attorney who knows what he or she is doing would do that, but I think that we run some risk that attorneys might do that, waive their client's constitutional rights without consulting, and so this requires the defendant personally agree to do that. And I think that's a good safeguard. It requires that the attorney inform the client of what's involved. Starting on line 15 in subsection B, you have a list of the things that are additional information that the defendant can get. The primary provision there is, well, probably little I and actually, all of them are important. It's basically names and addresses of witnesses, people who know information about the crime, and any written or recorded statement that they have given. Those are under the current rule, and we would and this provides that this be additional discovery that the defendant can get. Starting on line 28, and this language comes from the Criminal Rules Committee draft. The prosecutor shall inform the defendant of the names and addresses of expert witnesses who have performed work in connection with the case, and shall give over their reports. Again, that's something the defendant can get if he chooses to do so.
Dean, on page 2. Lines 8. The prosecution must give to the defendant books, papers, etc. that were obtained from him or belonged to him.
Right.
That were seized. I take it that does not include then statements made by the accused.
That's correct.
Okay.
These are tangible objects. The statements would be part of the additional discovery that the defense could get.
But that's it, Green?
Since we have gone back a little bit on page 3, on the 2, that the portion that you mentioned, the personally executed by the defendant, has been added in. Is there somewhere else that if we, by chance, were trying to bring in, let me rephrase that, if the defendant were impaired or some other thing, even maybe deceased, but because of an action that he may have done, there's an action caused. Now, would this in any way impair that, or is there some other part of law that takes care of that?
In other words, if the defendant is not competent to,
uh-huh.
I think that if a defendant is not competent to assist his attorney and to participate in the proceedings, the court will, in essence, stop the proceedings until the person is competent, refer him to a psychiatrist or something like that. So the question of whether someone is competent to continue on is something that a court decides on an individual basis. The question you raise goes really to whether a court ought to question a defendant and make sure that that the defendant has been told of all his rights and understands what he's doing. And I'm not certain whether that's something that's absolutely necessary in these circumstances. For example, before someone can plead, can change his plea from not guilty to guilty, a judge will hold a hearing and will get the defendant personally in front of him and say, all right, do you understand what you're giving up? You understand you're waiving your right to a trial? You understand that there won't be a jury here you're pleading guilty and your attorney has talked to you about this and you understand and you're satisfied with your attorney's advice and counsel in this matter. And it goes through a litany of questions in order to make sure that the defendant is voluntarily and intelligently and knowingly giving up his right. The question is whether that kind of special separate hearing is necessary for this process. And my feeling is it's probably not, although it would unduly complicate the matter. And the question is whether as a constitutional matter it's necessary.
Isn't it somewhat analogous to the decision on whether he's going to take the stand?
Yeah. Right. Interestingly enough, our courts have ruled that now the judge has to make a personal inquiry of the defendant as to if he is not going to take the stand, whether he understands that he has a right to, et cetera, et cetera. So,
no, but I mean the converse.
If he
doesn't have to inquire.
Right. I think it is probably not necessary. Some judges may, in certain circumstances, if they question a defendant's mental capabilities, may do that anyway. But I think in most cases, it's probably not necessary.
And if he were physically, if he were physically incapable of doing it, he understands it, but he just can't sign it. He's agreed to it. But then can they come back and say, well, hey, Oakes didn't sign it like you've said he has to in law?
I think the courts can probably handle that situation, okay. I would imagine.
Just, if I may, for the benefit of the committee, Representative Parnell had to leave to chair a finance subcommittee. He didn't want us to interpret his leaving by a lack of interest in his bill. So.
Getting back to our line by line, and I apologize for going through this quickly, but it's a long bill, and I kind of wanted to get through it so that we had time to work on it, if that's necessary. On page 4, line 11, 12, 13, and 14, the provision that was there for any books, papers that had been obtained from the defendant, that has been moved up to what's now described as mandatory disclosure. But we still have the situation of books, papers, documents, photographs, or tangible objects which are intended to be used but were not obtained from or did not belong to the defendant. In other words, should there be a disclosure of that? And I think there should. So I would recommend leaving in that language where it appears right here, but without the qualifier which were obtained from or belonged to the accused. I mean, something like any books, papers, documents, photographs, or tangible objects which the prosecuting attorney intends to use in the hearing and which were not previously disclosed to the defendant. Something along those lines so that...
How about other than those obtained from?
That's good.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to leave that other than those obtained from?
That's just a suggestion at this point.
Or belonging to the accused? Or are we crossing out or belong to the accused?
Obtained from or belong.
Okay.
Or belonging, yeah.
Belonging, right. At the bottom of page 3, the language that, or page 4, I'm sorry, the language that is deleted there from lines 26 to 31, that language has been moved up to the front part of the bill as part of mandatory disclosure. This is the constitutional minimum. It is moved up to, to the bottom of page 1, the top of page 2. So it's deleted in this, in what has now become the back part of the bill. Page 5 are just provisions that currently exist in the bill with a few wording changes. Page 6, starting on line 3, the provision for expert witnesses here, which is additional disclosure to the prosecuting attorney, in other words, things that the defendant has to agree to turn over to the state, that's comparable to the provision that the prosecution has to turn over to the defense. In other words, we're trying to equalize both. So this same provision we previously saw as something the prosecution has to turn over, and that was bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4. So again, it's with respect to expert witnesses, it's the same information. And again, this was something that was recommended by the Criminal Rules Committee. But the Criminal Rules Committee worded their proposal a little differently. On page 6, line 5, where it says, names and addresses of any expert witnesses that are performing work in connection with the case, instead of that language, the defense committee, say defense committee because that was a... That's the way I view it. But the Criminal Rules Committee...
Freudian, perhaps.
Well, a bit of a Freudian slip. The Criminal Rules Committee language was the names and addresses of any expert witnesses that are likely to be called at trial. Now, that language is certainly better than the current rule, which says that the defense intends to call at trial, because we get right up on the eve of trial or mid-trial and defense says, well, I didn't intend to call him until yesterday. But our proposal is to make this provision exactly the same as the prosecution's obligation. That is, that if an expert has performed work in connection with the case, and this is, I think, particularly important when you have, for example, a public defender agency expending public funds to hire expert witnesses that say that, yeah, your client did it, and that information never gets to the state. I think that this is something that's appropriate to have in this provision. We've talked about lines 12 to 19 as being moved up to mm-hmm. page 2. Lines 20 to 23, legal research and records of defense counsel. There is currently a provision that says that the prosecution does not have to turn over its legal research materials and theories. And for some reason, there's not the current rule does not have something similar for the defense. And we thought it was appropriate in that both be equivalent. And so we have added a provision that says the defense doesn't have to turn over its legal research or theories, opinions, etc. And that simply allows a defense team or a prosecution team to have internal memoranda going back and forth about what we think about a particular case. Starting on line 24, this is probably the most, from the prosecution standpoint, the most critical information that the defense has that the prosecution needs, and that is, who are going to be the defense witnesses and what have they told your investigators? And that is information that when the defendant opts to get additional information from the prosecution, that's essentially what he agrees to give up the names and addresses of defense witnesses and what they have said. And this is comparable to the language that's used under the prosecution's obligation. At the top of page 7, again, we have this phrase which you've seen before, any books, papers, documents, or other tangible objects that the defendant may use as evidence or for impeachment at a hearing or trial. I think that in light of the Criminal Rules Committee proposal that imposes an obligation to turn over physical evidence to the prosecution, that there has to be some qualifying phrase in here, something about you've got to turn over all this as additional discovery unless it constitutes physical evidence under a previous subsection of the rule. I think that there are a lot of things that are books, papers, documents, photographs, etc., that are not physical evidence. I mean, they may be copies, for example, of something. Or for example, if you're going to introduce a textbook into evidence to prove a particular fact, we need to know about that, but it's not something that is strictly considered physical evidence in the same sense as a murder weapon, that you have an ethical obligation to turn over in advance. So if there could be a qualifier in there that something about, this is off the top of my head because I just looked at this as well, something about that does not constitute physical evidence under...
Well, just not covered by
the previous It's a little hard to figure out what this is. It's, I guess it's A1, two little I's, two DD. I mean, it's a sort of complicated citation to it.
What was it again?
I think it's rule 16A.
15A?
16A. 1, two little I's, two little D's.
And two little T's.
Now, all of the deleted language on pages 7 and 8, all of it on page 7 and down to line 10 on page 8, all of that has now been moved to the end of this rule as a new subsection G. And Mr. Luckhout thought that was the appropriate way to do that. It applies not only to defendants, but it applies to anybody who is the focus of a criminal investigation. And this is language under the current rule. It's been standard police practice for years and years, and it's not changed other than to shift its location in the rule. And that's for technical reasons that I don't argue with.
Just at the risk of clouding what we're doing here, we've got the lineup and the fingerprinting and all that sort of thing, and all this information was also discussed in the DNA testimony. Would that be appropriate to add that to the list? What we're trying to do.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that. This list includes the taking of a blood sample, if that's appropriate, and that's where we would get the DNA from. So that would be already being included in there.
Not necessary to say what type of tests we're going to
do. Right, that's correct.
And enough blood.
Court.
That'll do.
The remainder of the deleted language on page 8 has been moved up to earlier sections in the bill and put as either as either mandatory disclosure in the case of lines 11 to 20. There's been a slight change. There's been a changing in the wording, but that's been moved up to mandatory disclosure. I guess both of those. No, I take that back. Lines 11 to 20 are additional disclosure to the prosecutor. Lines 21 to 31 have been moved up. So those have, it looks like they've been deleted, but they really have been moved. We are getting near the end. On page 9, you see that there is a substantial amount of information that has been, or provisions that have been removed. This brings the rule back to the way it read about 3 years ago. And what this particular provision says is that anything that a defendant gets that has been, that the prosecution has or the police have, has to remain in the exclusive possession and control of the attorney. In other words, we don't want police reports, we don't want witness statements, we don't want those things given out to defendants and spread throughout the community. Unfortunately, that rule, as it read 3 years ago, was amended by the language that you see that is being proposed for deletion here now. And so the rule now reads that the only things that you have to keep in your possession are these few things: criminal history records, psychiatric exams, adoption records, pre-sentence reports, and things like that. In other words, it specifically allows police reports and witness statements to be given out. And what has happened as a result of that is that police reports have been spread throughout the community and in small towns, and you can imagine what happens. I mean, I have gotten calls from people who say, hey, what's the deal? All of a sudden I get this copy of this police report and I see that my name is mentioned in here as a witness. I thought these things were confidential. Why, you know, all of a sudden everyone knows that I'm involved. I think that's inappropriate. I don't think that attorneys intend that happen, but when they give over these things to their clients, that is what happens. It's particularly dangerous in cases involving the prisons, where you've got somebody in prison, and it may have been an assault occurring in the prison, and all of a sudden you've got a police report saying, who was giving information, all, and it spread throughout the facility. This has happened before, and I think it's appropriate to simply by deleting these provisions, bringing the rule back to the way it was 3 years ago, and requiring that defense attorneys keep this information in their possession. What that's going to do is that they can't just turn these things over to their clients. Let's see, pages 10, 11, and through the first part of 12, there are no changes other than minor wording changes. And on 12 and 13, you have the non-testimonial identification procedures currently part of the rule. They've been moved to the end of the bill. It's not not any new language, just a change in location. That, Mr. Chairman, is this bill, and it turned out to be a little more complex than I think we anticipated at the beginning.
Okay. Well, Dean, thank you very much. Before we go on to take the teleconference testimony, are there any other questions of Dean?
No.
Representative Veazey?
Yes, I'm just curious as to who all had input in the working of this. I mean, we don't have too much expression of interest here today, but...
Well, Representative Parnell's office has been consulted with respect to all of the changes that have been made all the way along the line. The primary drafter was Mr. Luckow. He's been consulting with me from time to time. In addition, our chief appellate attorney in Anchorage also had input on this. And to the extent that we've incorporated changes recommended by the Criminal Rules Committee, that's a committee made up of about 15 lawyers and judges from around the state who made the recommendations for those specific changes.
So you have a committee that's called the Criminal Rules Committee.
The Supreme Court has that committee. I mean, it's
appointed by the Supreme Court.
Appointed by the Supreme Court. That's correct.
I guess the big question I have is why isn't this committee's report taking the Supreme Court and getting them to adopt their own rule change?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the Criminal Rules Committee is appointed by the Supreme Court. It has traditionally, and I mean, I'm an advocate, and I certainly am working for the prosecution, and so you can take it with a grain of salt. But it is it has traditionally been made up of people who either are public defenders or defense attorneys or were former public defenders or defense attorneys. And the number of prosecutors has always been greatly outnumbered by the number of defense attorneys on that committee.
Okay,
and that's the reason. We have been trying to get provisions similar to these through that committee for the last 3 years. We keep telling them, well, there's going to be legislation. If you don't make some changes, there's going to be some legislation one of these days. There have been no changes. And really, as a practical matter, unless that committee makes a recommendation to the Supreme Court, it is unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to make a change to its rule. I mean, it has happened in the past, but ordinarily the court wants the committee to pass on something before it gets to it. So that's the reason.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dean. I am told that Randall Burns will probably not be online, although if he is, we'll certainly give him an opportunity to testify. But I believe we have two people in Anchorage, James McComas and perhaps Mike White. Is Mr. McComas there, available for testifying?
Yes, I am, sir, and Mr. White is not available, so of those two, I am.
Well, Mr. McComas, would you give us, for the record, your name and affiliation and your testimony, please?
Sure. My name is James H. McComas, McComas. I'm an attorney practicing in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been practicing in Alaska four times since 1988 fall, and was involved for about half the 2 years before that in litigation in Alaska. I've been a criminal defense attorney for 16 years. I would like the committee to know that although I only received notice of the subject I was going to be testifying about this morning, and then again, a big change in what I'd be testifying about when I saw this yes, there are some things that I think I can provide that would be useful. First off, as I understand it, the Criminal Rules Committee does have a modification to Criminal Rule 16 that they have proposed, because I have a copy of it on my desk here, and I have until February February 10th, 1995, within which to submit commentary. I think the committee better find out who's on that committee. I have not served on that committee, but I serve on the Criminal Jury Instructions Committee, and I can tell the court that by no stretch of the imagination is there a defense bias on that committee. I think the point of appointing people to the committee is to try and get people who are familiar with the area, somewhat expert in the areas, and to try and get some sort of a balance. And I assume that if we're referring to former public defenders, perhaps Mr. Canelli is talking about some judges. There are plenty of former prosecutors who sit on the other committee that I'm on. But before we discount the fact that there's a whole group of people who have already thoroughly considered and debated this, people who actually practice in the field and know what they're talking about, before we discount that on the assertion that it's a defense committee, I think you better find out if that's true or not. I don't know. I don't know who's on that committee. The second point I'd like to make, just in a broad overview that applies to either of the bills that I've seen, is this. The argument that we have to balance the procedures at trial, and specifically balance the discovery procedure, because it favors the defense now, is sort of like coming into an argument after it's already two-thirds done and making your decision based upon what's left. Historically, the imbalances, to the extent they exist, in procedure in the criminal justice system have explicitly been designed to provide some sort of balance the other way, protectively of the defense, given the incredible advantages that the prosecution has that never get talked about when we focus on something like discovery out of the context. And the advantage that they've got that will end up playing into the provisions of these bills very much are, for example, the incredible disparate advantage in investigative resources. They have the police department, the state crime labs cooperation. Many times there are interagency cooperations, and the defense is lucky, quite frankly, if you're a defense lawyer and you can assign an investigator to work, say, one-fifth or one-sixth time on a major case, then you're actually providing a lot more resources than most defendants enjoy. So the idea that there's something wrong with the state who is supposed to be proving its charges handing over its witness statements when the defense doesn't have to do the same is easily understood in this context. If I've got limited investigative resources, I can direct them to what's really important, go out and find additional or supplementary information, not go over the same ground twice when I don't have the resources, frankly, to do it. The second way that this comes in is the discretion the prosecution has in charging a case. The defendant is there because an accusation has been made. He doesn't initiate the process. He's hailed into court to face a charge. I really don't think it's too much to expect that when a citizen is called into court and that kind of allegation made against him or her, that they could expect that they're going to have some substantial information about why they're there, what the allegations are, so that they can begin to prepare their defenses. So with that, those sort of overview remarks, and feel free to cut in or stop me at any time if there are questions. I guess what I would propose to do next at this point is to go ahead and talk about the present bill, which is the SC, or the CS, rather.
Do you have, Mr. McComas, the M version?
M version. Where would I find the M? Mm-hmm.
Top right-hand corner is the term repeated for the third time, work draft. Right under that is a list of numbers and letters, that the last of which should say slash M.
I think that's what I've got.
Okay.
It's in the upper right-hand corner of mine, but it does say 146 slash M.
Okay. That is the one that we have been discussing, and I hope that you have been able to listen to most of that.
Yes, I have, and I'll just limit my comments to sort of a couple of main areas that I think will make the point of what I'm trying to say. On page 6, for example, they talk about, before we get to 6, I guess I should address to begin with this issue of elective discovery, which was considered and rejected by the Criminal Rules Committee. The reason that the prosecution has to be proposing this to you is because under our Constitution, under our state constitution, they cannot, they call it balance the playing field, or as I call it, gain a further advantage over the advantages they already have. Because our courts have held and our Supreme Court has held that most of what they're proposing here would violate the privilege against self-incrimination. So instead of balancing that, what they're proposing to do is penalize the defense by taking away things like witness statements and other things, unless the defendant agrees to waive the privilege against self-incrimination to get more information. I mean, what we're voting for here essentially is a bill that codifies a requirement that people give up their constitutional right under the Alaska Constitution. They don't have the legal ability to make defendants give up that right now by simply passing legislation, so they have to have an actual explicit waiver. And to get that, they have to threaten the defendant. And so they threaten him with, well, you'll have to go to trial by surprise. You'll know virtually nothing, less even than in a federal court. So if you want to get away from that, just give up your privilege against self-incrimination, and then you provide yours and we'll provide ours. Well, the reason that our Constitution doesn't permit that, and the case is a famous case called Scott, is the understanding that these kinds of discovery favors to the defense are simply intended to counterweight the tremendous investigative and charging advantages that the prosecution starts with. So my first position to you would be that this legislature should not be in the business of, because the prosecutors want to win more trials, passing a bill that requires every defendant that wants to learn what the case is about him to give up his constitutional right not to incriminate himself. Looking specifically at page 6, and candidly acknowledged by Mr. Kennelly, this provision, that the defense would be required to give out not only the names and addresses of expert witnesses that are performing work, and by the way, there's essentially this requirement in the rules today, you have to disclose reports of your experts, there's long before, frankly, my practice is long before 30 days before trial when I know I'm going to use the person. But they want to expand it to just anyone that performs work, and they candidly admit to you that the reason they want to do that is if the defense hires a psychiatrist who says that the person is faking and is sane and ought to be convicted, they want to be able to capture that work product and introduce it into court. And if we lived in an inquisitorial system of justice, something like that might seem like a good idea. But when we live in an adversary system of justice like we have now, where we refuse to make people incriminate themselves, where we protect what they have to say, be it to psychiatrists or anyone else, that kind of proposal has no place in our system. That's a fundamental misunderstanding of American criminal justice. And all you have to do is look at the federal discovery rule to find that out. The federal discovery rule, and nowhere is discovery more restricted from the defense point of view than in federal court, requires only the disclosure of information about expert conclusions that are intended to be used at trial. Okay, that's fair. If we're going to use it, they need notice because they may need an expert of their own, that sort of thing. But the idea that we can turn discovery into a tool that's going to now let the prosecution get all of the things that the defense found out in trying to prepare a defense that, in fact, hurt the defendant, well, the impacts of that on our system are incalculable. Number one, no defendants, no persons accused of crimes will have any faith in their attorneys. If an attorney says, I want to look into this area, and then it turns out it doesn't come out right, but because it's an expert report, we have to give it over, the essentially attorney-client relationships in criminal cases will be destroyed. Second of all, it's not necessary. The state always overwhelms the defense with resources, with a possible exception of the O.J. Simpson case. But actually, if you take a look at the amount of resources that the public is putting into that prosecution as well, it's probably true that even with all of the millions that Mr. Simpson had to spend, that he's being outgunned. Well, it's clearly the case in Alaska trials. And so this isn't necessary, and requiring it to be shown is plainly unconstitutional. I don't have any doubt that the Supreme Court, by telephone, would conclude that a discovery provision that required the defense, say, in a DWI case, to turn over information, expert information, that was adverse to the client, when the defense did not intend to use that information at trial, would be a reversible error. That's simply not the way our system works. Second problem with this is that the rule itself says failure to provide timely disclosure entitles the prosecutor to a continuance. Well, this is, you know, interesting, and it shows you the great prosecution bias of this bill. Nowhere in the proposal does the defense get entitled to a continuance. I mean, violations of discovery rules have always been for the trial judge to decide what to do about. Does it merit a continuance? Does it require something stronger? Should I let it go with an admonition? And the main thing that gets considered is there any prejudice? That is, does the prosecution really need a continuance? Or does the prosecution not? So it strikes me as quite interesting that in a couple of these provisions where the defense is required to disclose, specific and immediate remedies are provided that the prosecution wants, whereas when the prosecution violates discovery provisions, it's left to the discretion of the court to come up with the appropriate remedy. And that's just plain unfair on its face. And I would think the better rule would be that discovery provisions, when they're violated, should be left to the court to fashion an appropriate remedy, because the court will be in the best position to decide what that is. Then if we look down at the bottom of page 6, names and addresses of defense witnesses, this cannot be compelled under the Alaska Constitution. So this election idea means that people are going to have to give up their privilege against self-incrimination. The Supreme Court's already ruled on this, already ruled and held that the there's some pretty cogent arguments in there, some pretty cogent authority cited in there explaining why discovery is the way it is in criminal cases. Just for your information, that's at 519 Pacific 2nd, 744. Alaska, 1974. But I believe that we're going to find that requiring the defense to turn over names and addresses of witnesses and or their statements, particularly if they aren't people that the defense, for that matter, intends to call, and there's no such limitation as I see it here. So, for example, the defense investigator goes out and finds a damaging witness the police haven't found. Under this proposal, the defendant's own agent becomes the source of his destruction. That's the justice that operates in an inquisitorial fashion, where there is no prosecutor to speak of, and the court itself to find out whatever all the facts are. That's not the system of justice we have in this country. And frankly, the reason we don't is we've got a very diverse population, and we've got a lot of experience with abuses of power. And police abuses, police perjury, just like witness abuse and witness perjury are not unknown. I think that any effort to include this in the bill is, you know, you can pass such a bill, but it's going to be summarily kicked by the Supreme Court. The only, I'm aware of no provisions, for example, in federal discovery, the most limited of all, that require the defense to produce for the prosecution anything other than what it intends to introduce at trial. And that, and much less than that, frankly, because witness statements and things like that are simply not included. And then I guess the final thing I wanted to comment on was this materials to remain in the exclusive custody of the attorney. First of all, I am not aware of, either from my own practice or from reading the newspaper and watching the television about criminal cases, of some great problem. I don't know what phone call or phone calls Mr. Ganelli got, but I really think that one of our big problems in criminal legislation is the tendency to try and do it on the basis of anecdote. If there ever was a case in which a person out on bail committed this kind of crime, then all people like that ever charged will be held. That kind of reasoning, and that's what I'm afraid we're getting into here. In prison cases, where I can understand there might be some justification in more greatly restricting defendants' access to materials, the prosecution can apply to the court for exactly that kind of restriction, state its basis. But the other side of this coin is the defendant's the person on trial. And they not only have a right to know what the case is against them, but they're often one of the main sources of information that's helpful in preparing the defense. And if the defendant can't read over the accusations being made against him by some other person, how is he going to prepare a defense? Well, maybe that's not what the implication here is. Maybe the implication is the defendant can come into my office and read and write notes as much as he wants. He just can't take the documents out. Well, the problem with that is, what if the client's in jail? Now the public defender gets to go over and sit with the client for 2 or 3 days in a row while he reads through the discovery file in a homicide case because he can't provide him with a copy. This makes no sense, and there's no demonstrated need for it whatsoever. I guess it's like kind of the other side of the coin. I'd say to you, you shouldn't be providing prosecution witnesses with copies of the statements they gave to defense investigators, because they'll just change their testimony before they get up to testify on the stand. I mean, I can give you as many anecdotes as you have time to listen to where that happens, but that's no better basis for legislation than a couple of phone calls that have been received. Rule 16, the way it presently exists, vests in the court the right to regulate discovery and to enter more limiting orders for special situations, and I would think that would be adequate. So that, Mr. Chairman, is the best I can do on about 25 minutes' notice. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McCullis. Are there any questions at the committee? I see none. Thank you very much for covering something that you had to do with quick reading, I'm sure, but an obvious area that you're familiar with.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me just say, in general, know that I am interested and available in the event that the court requires testimony on other criminal bills. My number is 907-258-0704, and I'll be happy to work with the committee.
Okay, thank you. I see we've developed one question, Representative Tuig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, being new on the Judiciary Committee. How certain is the sponsor of the bill and Mr. Quinelli that this is going to be not taken and through courts?
Overturned.
Overturned.
Dean, can you give us a risk estimate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tuig, it's certainly going to be taken through the courts, and the question is whether it is going to be overturned. I think there's no question that anyone, defendant or any person, can give up constitutional rights if they are of a mind to, and if they feel that it's to their advantage to do so, as long as. And Representative Green had asked the question: is, you know, how do we make sure that someone is competent to do that? But I think that that you can give up your constitutional rights, and if you feel that there's an advantage in doing that, and we can condition that based on any number of criteria, and this is one of them. As I indicated last week, the current rule gives the defense much more information than is constitutionally required. And we can put some limits and some conditions on that. And so on that basis, and as long as there is a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of constitutional rights, there isn't any reason to believe that the courts wouldn't uphold that.
President Bundy?
Well, thank you. I think my question has been partially answered, that the previous testimony had, as I heard it, indicated that all this disclosure was wiped out, but by this bill. But as I understand the bill, there still are the constitutional mandates regarding disclosure, and what this bill is talking about, additional disclosure beyond the constitutional mandates. Am I correct in understanding that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, not only does this require that the state still provide what's constitutionally required, but it there's even within the mandatory disclosure in this new rule, there are other things that the state is not required to disclose, but we're giving to them anyway, such as access to grand jury materials, that sort of thing. So the answer to your question is yes, and we're even giving them a little bit more than we're required to give, even if they don't opt into these provisions.
I guess for the committee, that we've touched on it, but I guess haven't laid it out clearly. The constitutional right that has been referred to by Mr. McCormick and Mr. McGuinelli is the right against self-incrimination. Basically, our Constitution says, and I'm paraphrasing, no one can be forced in a criminal proceeding to furnish testimony against themselves or against their interest or something like that. All these other specifics on what documents or statements or physical pieces of evidence that might comprise has been developed by rules and court decisions and other things. So it's a bit of a misstatement to say that a defendant has an absolute constitutional right to the statement of a witness that's going to be against him. No, that's a developed court decision that has put that in that category, and that court decision can be overcome by 2/3 rule, because there's nothing in the Constitution that says that. What the bill purports to do, I think, is to try to establish a level of comfort of things that will be transferred back and forth within the general constitutional right that can't be waived, and then supply other things that can be on a balanced scale procedure.
Thank you.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a number of questions I wanted to ask while Mr. McComas was still in line. Can I go ahead with those?
Certainly can.
Mr. McComas, could what's the significance of the higher level of information that would be available in the case there was this reciprocal agreement? What would it be like trying to argue a case without it?
Well, I think there's a couple of different answers to that. One is that without access to witness statements that have been taken by the prosecutors, investigators, which is the law enforcement officials, without access to those statements until the people actually testify at trial, the defense will be much figure out who the witnesses are and to interview them anyhow, so they'll learn some of this information. But on the other hand, there'll be a lot of the information that they won't get until the trial starts. And then you're going to get into case after case of the defense moving for mid-trial continuances and postponements so they can adequately read and prepare based upon the new information that they just got. If the new information that they don't get until the witness testifies at trial indicates that a whole other line of defense is likely to be more successful, there are going to be motions for mistrials based on that new information that wasn't previously provided. And to the system in general, since most cases, criminal cases, don't go to trial, my belief is that more restriction in the information the prosecution shares with the defense is going to lead to a greater increase in the number of trials, a significantly greater increase. And I guess I'd also like to say, although this isn't directly responsive to your question, that in the federal system, where there is the really supposedly the constitutional minimum of discovery provided, my experience in the federal system has been that it varies entirely from district to district. You get Rule 16 discovery in Anchorage, but in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, you get over the file. And so the fact that the bill says this is all that you're entitled to doesn't mean that district attorneys around the state are all going to uniformly enforce it. And the reason that many experienced prosecutors do not like Rule 16 discovery limitations in the federal system and afford open file discovery is because they realize that the large number of pleas that they have to get to keep the system going with the limited resources it has are promoted by providing that kind of disclosure.
David? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask a question, Mr. Guinelli?
Certainly.
Why would we want to require the defense to provide more information additional to what they're going to use at the trial? Why would we want to ask them to produce things on top of that they aren't going to use at the trial? Volumes are just out of my naivety about discovery, having not been through these things, but it doesn't seem to be discovery to prepare for a trial if you're asking them to produce something they aren't going to use in the trial.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finkelstein, the defense will not use something likely because it hurts them, and that is something that likely will assist the prosecution. Right now, and even under this proposal, the prosecution would be required to turn over everything to the defense if the defense opts in, even those witness statements where the prosecutor does not intend to use them at trial, even that information that was developed by experts where there is no intention to use the expert at trial, if an expert was consulted and rendered an opinion, all of that would be turned over by the prosecution to the defense. And I suppose that the same question could be asked in the other direction. Why is it appropriate to do that? But in our view, work that has been done that has generated information about a particular case, information about a particular incident, is going to ultimately further the cause of truth-finding. And the more information that the finder of fact has to base a decision on, the better that decision is likely to be. That's the best answer I can give.
Representative Finkelstein?
Mr. Chairman, it sounds like you're saying there's no difference in the position of the state, which its role is to try to find justice, and even if the justice doesn't involve convicting this one person, versus an individual whose constitutional right is to defend themselves. I mean, that doesn't seem to me an equal position. If the state of Alaska finds something contrary, of course we're trying to find the guilty party, not convict one person. That's not what it's about from the state of Alaska's point of view. If someone else is guilty, then in the interest of the state, it's all the same. But for a person defending themselves, of course, it's a different situation. We've given this right to defend themselves, to not incriminate themselves. I don't see how you can, make this case that the information they both have their hands on is the same significance. Doesn't the state have a different role in these cases than individual?
Mr. Chairman, I suppose the same argument could be directed toward the provision that even the Criminal Rules Committee thought was appropriate to include, and even our Supreme Court has found to be the ethical obligation of attorneys, and that is when the defense attorney comes into the possession of tangible evidence, the murder weapon, it has an obligation to turn that over to the prosecution, to the police. And the same argument could be made. I mean, someone has a constitutional right to defend themselves, and why should they have to turn over evidence to the police? But I think that the overall societal interest is in making sure that we have all the information that we have in front of the jury or the judge. And again, I'm kind of repeating the same point that I made a while ago.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Finkelstein?
That example doesn't, you picked a pretty extreme one. The reason we have that is because there's going to be plenty of places where the defendant's going to, if that wasn't the case, they'd give the knife or whatever it is to their attorney, and they'd be protected. I mean, it would provide a loophole in which actual evidence, hard evidence, could be kept out of the realm of the court system. I think there's a reason for that exception. That doesn't disprove the different role that the state of Alaska plays in seeking justice and in trying to find the proper person who committed a crime versus individuals trying to protect themselves. I'm not sure. I don't think my question was answered by that example, which is a different circumstance.
Well, I would disagree. So I guess I think we're getting into a philosophical discussion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this bill is philosophy at its most basic thing.
Yes, it is. Yes,
is do you take a bill that seems to me to be a prosecutor's dream come true and try to put some other element to it? Because all the people Mr. Grinnell described as being involved in preparation of this bill, I was waiting to hear some element of it, some public defender role. Is there anyone involved in the preparation of this bill who has any sort of defense point of view?
No, not directly in the drafting of this bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I'm not allowed to ask questions, how are we ever going to get that side presented?
Well, I don't want to. I would say that his statement was correct in terms of that no one from the defense point of view contributed to the draft, but we've had testimony last week from the defense attorney, the public defender of the state, who made some suggestions that have been incorporated into this draft. So, yes, and we just received testimony from Mr. McComas, who most certainly represents the defense bar. So we're getting both sides of the picture. It'll be up to the committee to decide which proportion of which picture they'd like to place in this bill, and that's the process that we're going through.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm asking questions, and I have a number of them, is because this is a very complicated subject. I'm not completely certain myself, and I'm learning as we go as to where these things stand. Every bit of discussion we've had so far has brought new points to me that I was completely unaware of before, both from the previous witness and Mr. Grinnelli. And I would hope to be able to pursue asking Mr. Grinnelli questions.
You may certainly pursue, within reasonable bounds, asking Mr. Grinnelli any question. What I am going to try to curtail is philosophical debate at this stage with someone who's presenting testimony.
Oh, okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I still state for the record, though, that I think there's a different role that the state plays in pursuing justice and individual in defending themselves, and that it's not automatic that the same rules should apply. Mr. Chairman, the question came up in Mr. McComas's testimony, which I wanted to present to Mr. Grinnelli. Why would we want to say that any failure to provide timely notice provides for an automatic continuance on one side and not on the other?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finkelstein, I appreciate that Mr. McComas did not have a lot of time to review this draft. I don't think any of us had a lot of time to review it, but I at least was familiar with some of the things that went into it, and I think he's wrong about that particular point. On page 4, line 3, I think, as to that specific point about the reports, the notice and reports of experts, it says failure to provide timely notice shall entitle a defendant to a continuance, and if that isn't enough, to other sanctions, including prohibiting the prosecutor from calling the expert at trial. Actually, I think the Criminal Rules Committee also added another clause about declaring a mistrial, which is not included in here, but I think the court can impose other sanctions. But that provision for an automatic continuance is in there as well for the defense.
Attorney Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I ask Mr. McComas, if, in looking at that section, if it seems to him that addresses his concern?
That's correct. I see that in this draft, there is the same language for belated disclosure of expert witnesses for either side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the other question, another one Mr. McComas brought up, is how does a defendant in jail read the record?
Mr. Chairman, I think that I think what has to be recognized is the proposal in this committee substitute is to go back to the language that existed in the rule for many, many years, and that was modified just about 3 years ago, I think. And so I guess the answer to the question is it would return the situation to that which existed before about 1991 or 92. It's no doubt going to be the case that it may be more difficult in some circumstances for a defense attorney to discuss a case with a client. It will require perhaps an additional, you know, face-to-face meeting rather than just giving someone a 20-page police report saying, here, read this in your cell, write me a letter, and let me know what you think about this. I think that there are other justifications for having that be the rule.
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I may have missed this earlier in your testimony, if so, I'm sorry, but you were mentioning that the committee that exists, appointed by the Supreme Court, hadn't made any recommendations to the Supreme Court on this. Are you aware of what Mr. McComas was referring to, some sort of current process going on with a deadline coming up for recommendations on this area? Is that, did I understand him, Mr. McComas, correctly, that this is actually going on now?
You did, and I I think that was something that I mentioned at the beginning of my testimony. You may not have been here at the time, but yes, the Criminal Rules Committee has recommended a number of changes that are currently being considered by the Supreme Court, and those have been incorporated into this draft in the way I've described with some wording changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Grinnelli. Could I just ask Mr. McComas if there's any if I correctly stated his concerns in those matters, just so it's...
I believe so, Representative Finkelstein. The one thing I'd like to point out, though, just so we're all clear, to say that the changes that the Rules Committee is proposing to the Supreme Court have been included in this draft, we have to say something more for that sentence to be accurate. And the something more is this, that the Rules Committee explicitly considered and was unable to get a sufficient consensus to propose the very election of discovery choice that this bill proposes. And it should not, essentially what's come out of the committee after they've argued this thing all the way out is that they have increased in, I think, three areas the explicit requirements of disclosure on the defense. But they haven't come anywhere near witness statements, witness lists. They certainly haven't said that the defense has an obligation to turn over evidence of conviction. Unlike the prosecution, which of course has to hand over evidence that cuts against its case, because, as you pointed out, they're supposed to be doing justice. They don't just have one person to represent. So you can say that some of the things that have been recommended by the Criminal Rules Committee have ended up in this proposal, but what you have to say to be accurate is that the committee itself ultimately could not agree to accept the notion of two tiers of discovery, one for those who are willing to try and waive and advance their constitutional rights, one for those who are not so inclined.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Mr. McComas is certainly correct on that point, and I think I tried to allude to that when I was responding to Representative Veazey's question about the Rules Committee and why why this is taking this route instead of that. I mean,
if I could ask one quick question of either Mr. McGuinelli or Mr. McComas, has the option, election, two-tier system, whichever description you'd like, it was my understanding that this has been put into effect in a couple of other states. Does anybody know?
I believe Representative Parnell indicated that Florida has such a rule, and he's talked to prosecutors down there who have used it, and I think his specific testimony was last week that in fact 99% of the defendants opt into to the system, and that was in response to, I think, the feeling of the Criminal Rules Committee that defendants would not opt into the system, and experience in Florida is just the opposite.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the figures on that. The last I heard about discovery in Florida was that it was, I suppose, what you call a defense goldmine, because you could note the depositions of prosecution witnesses and actually require them to talk to you under oath prior to trial. So it is conceivable that there are inducements in that reciprocal discovery situation that that are far different from what we're talking about here. I've got here a copy of the report, the majority report of the Criminal Rules Committee. Is about 6 pages, and it discusses the very in and out opt-in system that's been proposed to you. Does the committee, has the committee seen this report?
Nope. I have not, no.
If you would like me to, I also have the little over 2-page minority report. I'd be happy to pass these materials to you.
I think that would be helpful. I'm getting a sense that we're not going to be moving this bill today. Do you have our fax number, Jim?
You could provide it. I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Real quickly. The committee fax number is 258-5510.
That's English.
I'm sorry. That's not right.
Okay.
But the right one is 465-3834.
465-3834.
That's correct.
All right. I'll have my office send those out directly.
Thank you. I see no one objecting, so you bet. And thank you again very much.
The Lieutenant General's office has seen those reports, and so we've read those, so we're aware of those.
Okay.
Also, the concern about depositions, we are carrying another bill that deals with that.
Yeah.
And we explained to the Florida people that, yeah, that would correct the problem we're having, which they intend to correct themselves.
Okay. We have discussed two or three suggestions for amendments that may or may not really be that controversial, but rather than go through the amendment process now and then still have a document that we just laid on the table today, what I'm going to suggest we do is ask that those adjustments that we've described, if it is the sponsor's wish, be put into a CS and get it to the members just as soon as we can. When that is done, we will utilize the 24-hour rule and put this back on the schedule, and hopefully get right at it. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will we also get copies of the facts then?
Yes, I'll have them distributed. Representative Finkelstein?
Mr. Chairman, if I'm sure that to some degree we are already doing this, but if Representative Parnell's office could run some of this by the movers, either by Mr. McComas or Mr. Salemi, I think it'd be a big help. The I don't mean to any of my comments indicate that I'm completely against the ideas behind this. It's just they are tough things to understand, and we've got to find a bit more consensus on these things. I mean, certainly before it gets through the legislature, I think it takes 2/3 to pass these things, right? And my question might be a little naive and few of the things, but there's going to be plenty of people in Florida who are going to feel the same way. It's probably better than how we can solve the things that we solve. So.
I don't disagree with that at all, and we'll certainly get that information.
This draft is coming up today, so we haven't had the opportunity to hear from, but we haven't asked given that.
Sure. I guess the adversarial system that has been described is such that we're the ones that are supposed to make the compromises, but the prosecutor and the defense attorney don't, you know. So I'm not expecting that they will come together, shake hands, say this is a great piece of legislation. I've tried that for 2 years and it hasn't worked. So at some point in time, we have to make some decisions, but...
Right, but if we're writing it from scratch, you know...
Right. Actually, I tried that for 30 years and it didn't work. That is the only thing we have, and I think this is an issue worthy of the length of time that we're spending on it, obviously. So I will do as I have described, rather than take up any more time. Is there anything else? Okay, we stand adjourned.